Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Hey, folks, I'm Andy. It's 908 on KDXU. My buddy Zach is here. Zach Renstrom from the Washington County Water Conservancy District. He's even got the logo on his chest today, Water Conservancy District logo.
Yep.
Welcome, Zach. Thanks for coming in, man.
It's always good to be here.
I thought today we could talk a little bit about water and how it applies to everyone and some of the trivial things about water. For instance, maybe people didn't know this, Zach, but, and I know you did, but there is the same amount of water on Earth right now as there was when dinosaurs walked the Earth millions of years ago. It's a closed system.
Yeah.
Right? Water doesn't just drift out into space.
Yeah.
That would actually be a bad thing if it did, I think.
Well, that's kind of what happened to Mars.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, pretty much.
Venus. And, yeah. So,
technically, if you turn the tap on and get a glass of water, it could contain molecules that the dinosaurs drank millions of years ago, theoretically.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
It just keeps going back and forth.
I read a thing, and maybe you can confirm or deny this, that tap water is actually held to stricter standards than bottled water. And so tap water is generally more clean than bottled water. Is that true?
It depends.
Okay.
And so the bottled water is regulated by the FDA, and it's treated as a food product.
Right.
Where tap water is the EPA, and so traditionally drinking water had stricter standards, but there are some private organizations for bottled water that came out and they kind of set their own private standards. And so if you follow those private standards, they have very strict standards, but if you just follow the FDA standards, then drinking water is generally healthier. And that's one of those things. I could go off on bottled water for a while because not all bottled water is the same either.
Right.
And
right.
But most of the time what they do with a lot of bottled water is they just take tap water and maybe run it through a Brita filter or a carbon filter.
Yeah.
And then they put it in a bottle.
Bottle it and send it to you to sell it for $1.75 or whatever.
In fact, when I worked in Bountiful City as a young engineer, we had an individual that was just using a lot of water. And so we thought he may have a leak. But what he was actually doing was bottling water in his garage.
And selling it.
And it was really funny because it talked about this mountain spring water and how pure it was and kind of goes through all this other stuff, which Bountiful City water it was, and talks about the Mormon pioneers. And like it was a really funny write-up, but really was just tap water.
Wow.
So.
Was he allowed to keep doing what he was doing?
Yeah.
Well, technically doing anything illegal, right?
No, we thought he just had a leak, and it was kind of, so we just kind of looked into it when we realized it wasn't a leak at the time. The city said, okay.
All right. That's kind of cool. One of the things I'm really fascinated with, and you're an engineer and, you know, you're into science. I think you're kind of an amateur geologist as well. My dad was a geologist, but the power of freezing water is phenomenal to me. I remember in geology class way back in college, my dad was a geologist, so I had background in this stuff, but they would say, hey, you see this crack in the rock or you see this formation or whatever, that happened because of water freezing. And I'm like, no, wait, come on, really? Yeah. And they're like, no, seriously, if water gets in the cracks of a rock, just little teeny cracks, and then freezes, it expands.
Yeah.
Not a ton, but enough.
About 10%, yeah.
Yeah, and that can actually break rocks in half. It can change the face of the surface of the earth. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, the crystallization of water is a very, very strong force. And this is where the nerd in me starts to come out, where we start talking about the hydrogen bonds and how water is and stuff like that. And so, but yeah, when you freeze water, it can split solid rock right in the center of it.
And you think about, you know, some of the hardest rocks we have, granite and stuff like that. And if water gets in a crack and freezes, granite is not going to stop it from breaking the rock. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So, wow. So we love water. Is this why you went into water? Is how strong it is?
I will say I love engineering. I just found it fascinating, and for some reason, the just when I was taking my early engineering classes, how water runs. And so in engineering, we do these hydraulic models and stuff. And for some reason, my brain had an easier time running those things than, let's say, mechanical engineer, where you're just talking about a force on a welded joint. And so I love being outdoors. And so those were kind of the two reasons that drove me to be a water resource engineer.
Let's talk about the water, the makeup of water in different locations. I went to Philadelphia on my mission, and I just remember the tap water tasted like dirt. And then I come home, and we have such wonderful water here in Utah, and I just didn't want to drink the tap water there. I know there are guidelines and restrictions and things, but tell me about why water would taste like dirt in a big city.
So I also served a mission in Philadelphia.
Yeah,
we talked.
Great place, yeah.
So they get it out of the Schuylkill River, and the Schuylkill River is not known for being a pristine river.
No.
I think they call it the Schuylkill Sludge.
By the way, it's spelled S-C-H-U-Y, Kill. Yeah. And it's pronounced Schuylkill. You're right.
So the main reason why water... So I have very sensitive taste. And so water to me tastes vastly different. Like, even though, let's say, this is water. And so they actually have water tasting contests.
And
oh, yeah. And why water tastes the way it does is because there is trace minerals in that water.
Mm-hmm.
And even very, very small amounts of trace minerals, the human body is amazing how it can taste those. So like salt. Like, if there's just a little bit of salt in water, you'll be quickly... You can taste that. At least I can taste it.
Even just a little teeny bit. Huh?
Yeah. So, like, we try to keep our water, our salt levels here to about 500 milligrams per liter, between about 700 and 500 milligrams per liter. But you can go up to 1,000 milligrams per liter for TDS. And I can totally taste that. Like, there is a taste to that. And so in Philadelphia, they probably they have a high TDS. So they have higher salts in their water, and so you can taste that. And so, but sometimes certain minerals make the water taste a little bit better. And so harder water, sometimes, you know, that leaves those water spots on your, that actually makes the water taste a little bit better. And so there's just a lot of these little tiny microchemicals that make water taste it is. If you go to bottled water, we just talked about, if they go through a reverse osmosis process where they strip pretty much everything out of the water, they will add certain minerals back into water to help improve its taste. And so there's just all these things that they can do. And the chlorine levels kick off certain tastes. But we're very fortunate here in that our water is really pure. Like, we have excellent water. We test it constantly. Every single day we're constantly testing it. And because we get our water from essentially above from Zions National Park, we're very fortunate that we don't have a lot of those man-made chemicals too that the Schuylkill River has.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, so compare our water, how much you're allowed, I mean, you said about 500, what was it?
Milligrams per liter.
Milligrams per liter. There we go. Compared to that, the pod temp, the hot springs, and the amount of minerals that come out in that we can't use that water. What's the comparison ratio-wise?
So here we're talking, you know, hundreds. The hot springs is producing thousands. So it's like between five, I've seen 10,000. It mixes with the Virgin River, so it depends a little bit where you test it. But yeah, sometimes it can get up to like 10,000.
So that would be 20 times.
That's why if you drink that water, it would kill you fairly quickly.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's toxic.
Well, you think of salt water.
Yeah.
Like the ocean. Mm-hmm. And if you drink that, you get dehydrated fairly quickly and die. Well, what's coming out of the hot springs is substantially higher than that. And there's other chemicals in there, too.
Wow.
So there's a lot of funky stuff coming out of the ground up there.
Yeah, for sure. Go ahead.
People love to bathe in that stuff.
Yeah?
So,
it's supposed to be good for the skin, maybe? I don't know.
I will say that I was... people really get into these sulfur springs and stuff like that. And so... there's like kind of like this following that goes all over with these sulfur springs, and people like to bathe in them, and they talk about the health benefits. And there is, like, it's, you know, if you have arthritis or certain conditions, you get in really warm water. And also there's, I'm not a doctor. I want to make sure that's clear, but this is just me researching.
He just plays one on TV.
No, well, it's interesting because there was a sulfur spring that people with leprosy used to go to and get cured. And back in the day, they thought it was like this magical spring. Well, it was just the minerals and the sulfur in that springs that would kill the leprosy.
Hmm.
and cure people. And so it does, there's some, these sulfur springs do sometimes have medicinal effects.
By the way, years ago, my dad, along with meteorologist Clayton Bruff, wrote a book called Scientific Evidence for Biblical Miracles. Oh. And I'm wondering if that, you know, treatment for leprosy, I don't know if I read the book, but it was like 20 years ago,
yeah,
or maybe 30 years ago, but that, I wonder if that would fit right in with that. Anyway,
yeah.
All right, what about that hot springs out there? There's supposed to be a resort being built. What's the status on all that?
So it's actively under construction right now. It's okay. Located in Leverkin.
It's gone vertical, as McRae likes to say?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you drive out there, they've got a lot going, and hopefully... I'm not sure exactly when their timeline is, but next year they hope to open. And essentially what they're doing is they're going to pump that hot springs water, and then they're just going to have a series of pools that it kind of cascades through that the public can go and enjoy that. And one thing that's nice is it's getting them out of the floodplain. It's getting them out of the rock fall. It's also going to be managed really nice and make sure it's very family friendly. The city of Leverkin was heavily involved in getting it all set up. And so, yeah, in about a year, it'll be a really nice resort that people can go to. And if, like I said, I hate that smell, so I don't get in it.
Okay.
But if people want to, they're going to have the ability to get in that water and enjoy that. And so hopefully about next summer, I think is their timeline to open that up.
All right. There was when we were going to college up at Utah State, there was a hot springs kind of up toward that, like between Brigham City and Logan, but I'm not sure. Anyway, there was the hot springs up there, and they actually had a water slide that slid into. It was kind of a cool thing.
Crystal Springs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I grew up there. And
you've
so,
been there, huh?
Oh, yeah, Crystal Springs. Oh. We had our senior prom there.
Really?
Or senior cotillion, yeah.
Right.
And no, it's...
Nobody pushed you in the water or anything like that?
Oh, when you have a bunch of teenagers, we're all pushing each other in. But it's
oh, cool.
That's a unique feature because that is... That's a natural hot springs, and then they have a natural, just regular spring. And the cold spring and the hot springs are located within, like, a couple of hundred feet from each other.
Wow.
And it's, they have some, this is the closest place in the world that a cold spring and a hot springs are located next to each other or something like that.
Well, maybe you can do better justice as to its location, because it was kind of in the back of my mind, memory-wise. It's where? Is it by Brigham? Or
it's north of Brigham City. Okay. Yeah, and I can't remember the name of the town. I should, but...
Okay.
It's a neat little resort.
Cool. Yeah, it was actually kind of fun to go there.
It's still open.
We had one little kid at the time. We went there a few different times with our little kid and just had a nice time. So.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking water today with Zach Renstrom. Carrie's here as well. Hi, Carrie. Good to see you. Appreciate you coming in. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about water rates. Now, this little water fact thing I was reading about talked about the rate of how much we pay for water. What is the water rate in southern Utah, in Washington County right now, and is it enough? And what is the graded rate for people that use more water than maybe they should?
Yeah. So we actually get criticized for this a lot, and I'm actually very proud of this, but we actually pay some of the lowest water rates in the western United States.
Now that boggles the mind because water is so precious here. You think it would cost more.
And part of that is just because, honestly, what the people did 100 years ago and the system that they set up and our laws that were set up here in the state of Utah, a lot of times 100, even 150 years ago, they were thinking forward. And they just weren't thinking about, hey, what about today? But they were thinking about their kids and their grandkids and even their great-grandkids. And so a lot of the infrastructure we have, a lot of our laws and everything that makes it so we have really cheap water here in southern Utah is because of the foresight of our, you know, the people that came before us. And so I got to recognize them. And I mean, even Ron Thompson in the 80s, he went out and he built certain things and got certain things done. And the reason we have cheap water here today is because of what Ron was doing in the 80s. And my goal is to keep that going. Okay. Now, in the state of Utah, we're required to have tier rates, meaning that you use a certain amount of water, but as you consume more water, your rates will continuously go up. And so if you're your standard water user here in Washington County, St. George, Washington City,
Somebody who lives in a house, basically.
Yeah, a 10,000 square foot lot, your water rate's around about $40 to $45 a month. Now, it might go up a little bit more in the summer, a little bit lower in the winter,
right?
But that's kind of a goal.
And that includes your average house, say, has a little lawn, maybe not a giant lawn, but a little lawn, showers, dishwasher, home use, et cetera. Nothing real, like, extravagant or anything.
Yeah, but your typical home. But then we do have a unique price structure that it goes up, and it's based a little bit on when you got your meter. If you've lived here a long time, your home's older, then you pay a different tier rate than a home that was just built like last month.
Okay.
And so we kind of go through those and we look at those tier rates. Part of it is because of Utah state law, but part of it is when a home goes and is built, we assume that home will have a certain amount of use. Mm-hmm. If they go over that use, then the system can't necessarily handle that, because it's going above our assumptions. And so those tier rates are also to help keep that in check. I mean, we have some people that are using a lot of water and they pay big water bills here in our area. And we reached out to them and talked to them about that. And they're like, yeah, we're good. We'll pay the higher rate.
We don't care. Right. That is another thing that boggles my mind.
Yeah.
It's almost flaunting it in your face, saying, I don't care. I'm going to use the water, and there's nothing you can do about it, I guess.
Yeah, and so there's people that pay substantial water bills, and if you look out through the state of Utah, there's a place up in Summit County where they pay their water bill is in the thousands of dollars every month.
Wow!
And they're just like, yeah, we'll pay it. So we do have these tier rates. So those that are using a lot of water.
By the way, Summit County is Park City for those that want.
Oh, yeah. So we do have tier rates. So those people that are using a lot of water, they are paying a lot more for water. But the standard user, we're trying to keep their water rate as low as possible.
If I were to, okay, so we just took out our grass in our front yard. We now have artificial turf in our front and our side yard. No more, we actually don't own any real grass now. We have a lot of vegetation still. We have plants and bushes and things. Good. And trees, but we don't have any grass. So if we were to say my bill, and I don't know what my bill is because my wife pays the water bill. So I'm sorry, I don't know.
No, it's good.
But say it was $50. What do you think we could get that down to? If we were really strapped for money and I said, man, we really got to conserve, what would be a real, I mean, could we get it down to $20 a month? Or is that kind of unrealistic?
That's a little unrealistic because everybody's paying a little bit of a base rate.
Okay.
And so if you use no water at all, there's still a little bit of a base rate that's generally about $20. It depends on what city you're in. It kind of goes up and down a little bit. So there's kind of that base rate. But if you and your wife really got it down low, I mean, there's people that pay, you know, $30, $25 a month in a water rate. Because they just don't use a lot of water.
That's pretty low, yeah.
Yeah, but a part of it is just, if you don't use any water, let's say zero, there's still a cost to the system because the pipe outside your house is aging, like the infrastructure is aging, and just we still have to go and inspect it and flush it and all that other stuff. And so
I wanted to talk for a minute about pool myths or maybe pool facts. I have a pool. I've said it before. It's not a big pool. It's like 14 by 28, so it's a small pool. But we have a cover, and we keep it closed at all times unless we are actually actively using the pool. It costs, obviously, you know, to fill a pool. Mm-hmm. It costs money. We had to have water to fill it. But with the cover on it, I'm guessing, and you've said this in the past, probably not using that much water from this point forward.
That's correct. So there's been studies that have been done on this, and yeah, if you keep a cover like and operate the pool like you do, then they actually use very, very little water.
Less water than if I actually had grass in that same space.
Yes. Now if it's uncovered, then it will use more water than grass. And so right now we have no rules on covers or anything like that. Sometimes insurance policies require you to cover it. So we just encourage people that if you are going to put a pool in, make sure it's a covered pool and then utilize it as much as you can, the cover, because that does stop the evaporation process. If you have a pool and you fill it up January 1st and you walk away and you don't do anything and there's no leaks, the amount of evaporation that will come off that pool is generally about 6 feet.
Wow.
And so that's how much water will evaporate out of a pool over a year period. And that's assuming you'd get a little bit of rain that would fall in the pool. But you still, I mean, this summer it's hot.
Oh, yeah.
And so you just get a lot of evaporation, especially during those summer months.
That's
so
crazy. That is absolutely crazy. I know it's funny. And by the way, the law and policy in almost any city in the state, maybe in the country, is you have to have a 6-foot fence around. Mm-hmm. If you own a pool, it has to be enclosed. with at least a 6-foot fence. We only had in our back, we only had a 4-foot fence and then with a little small railing on top. And so we were required by law to put our cover in. So we unintentionally were water smart. Oh. Now I'm glad we have it, of course. Yeah. But at the time, we're like, well, the city, St. George City, said you must have a 6-foot wall or you must have a cover. And so we put the cover on, and it turned out a really good thing. I'm glad we have it. We also have a little pond. It's a very small pond, maybe 4 feet in diameter, but it has a water pump that pumps the water up around through, so we're not continually paying for water, and it has, you know, the little floater regulator thing and stuff. But that one would be subject to evaporation, I suppose.
So usually if it's water that's falling like that, that has 3 times more evaporation than if it's just stagnant.
Really?
Yeah. And it makes sense. Like you're splashing it. There's splashes going on. There's more surface areas. The water drop falls to the air. And so a lot of people like those little tiny ponds in their backyard. And so on that, we just say, you know, keep them small because then there's less evaporation, but you still have that bubbling noise and that waterfall. And that's the thing with a lot of this landscaping and water is you can do some amazing things that are just beautiful that is still very, very water efficient. Like you can have a pool just... We ask you to put a cover on it. It's not mandated, just ask. If you want that falling noise of water, you can do that, but there's some designs you can do to make it more efficient.
Right.
You can make a very, very green landscaping with all these things. And so, yeah, we don't want just that rock ground cover. That's just ugly. But there's a lot of things you can do, and it's neat to see people starting to do that.
I do recall when we went to the Water Conservancy District and said we want to take our grass out and put artificial turf down. You guys were adamant, and it was part of the requirement. You don't just replace, you know, grass with no vegetation whatsoever. So we had artificial turf down, but we also planted some plants around. I mean, you know, I thought that was kind of a cool deal that you guys said, look, we don't want to become, what is it you say, we don't want to become Tucson, a concrete island?
Because there truly is a heat island effect that can occur, and some areas have made that mistake. And so when we were talking about this, and we worked very closely with the cities on how to do this landscape rebate program, and we kind of talked it all through and came up with that, saying, yeah, we just don't want to tear it out and pour concrete. We still want that green vegetation, that cooling effect.
I talked with a mayor, it was maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I said, so a lot of people are concerned about water use and growth, and, you know, are we going to run out of water? And her answer was, well, we go strictly by what we're told from the Water Conservancy District. That's how we put our policies together. You've made a statement a couple of times about we give them suggestions, and then it's up to them to make the policies. And so I kind of felt like, well, we got one side saying it's them, and I've got the other side saying it's them. Yeah. But ultimately, it is you, right? You say, well, this is what we can do.
So I have no regulatory authority.
Right.
I have no enforcement authority. I have zero of any of that. And so legally, I couldn't do anything that I, like, let's say we want to do something, we couldn't. And so really, we have to work with the cities. And so what I do is I go to the cities and say, here's your options. Here's your 10 different options, or here's your things that you can adjust. And so how do you want to do this? And the cities uniformly, like, it wasn't one city was just choosing. It was uniformly all the cities came and said, we want to continue economic growth. We want to continue to have a robust construction industry here. And I says, well, to do that, then we need to do X.
Right.
And they all agreed.
And there were no rebels, no pushback. Oh, no.
There was a lot of good questions. I mean, it wasn't something that just happened in one meeting. It was a 2-year process almost.
Right.
But it was a good discussion.
Very cool. Well, I think people can feel good about the fact that we do have I always call you the water czar. How about the gatekeeper? You're the gatekeeper making sure that, you know, water is going to be here long term.
That's my job.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. More with Zach after this timeout.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
9:36 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. I'm here with award-winning Water Conservancy District General Manager Zach Renstrom. Zach, Carrie told me you won an award. Now, I didn't take notes when she was talking, but I know you don't like to do this, but if you'll talk about yourself for a minute and this award, I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a great honor. So it was called the Utah Water Pioneer, and so every year... The
was there a cash prize, by the way?
No.
A trophy, a plaque?
There was a trophy and a plaque. Okay. It was okay, really, and I will say it's a very nice, it lights up even.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. And it's glass. It was really cool. My wife was even impressed with it. And my wife let me keep it out, out on the mantle. So I knew it was a nice one.
Wow. And if she's like most wives, they're not impressed with much of with their husbands anymore. Anyway, Water Pioneer?
Well, yeah, Utah Pioneer Award for the state of Utah, and it's a huge honor. I feel humble by it. So the Speaker of the House and the leadership of the state of Utah, they look and say, okay, this year who has helped drive water policy in the state of Utah the most in a positive direction? And so I was selected for that award, and it was a great honor. And so it was held at the Utah Water Policy Summit with the leadership of the Senate and the House and the governor's office. And then they just had people from all over the state of Utah. And so I received that award. And
fancy dinner and everything at the ceremony and all that?
Yeah, chicken.
Nice.
And, nice. It was a great honor. And it's neat. And it's, in some ways, I think it's a recognition of what we're doing down here in southern Utah, that we are doing a lot of really great, innovative things. And we're able to keep our economy growing and keep things moving and not letting water be an impediment to that. And so I feel it's also just a recognition of what we're doing down here in southern Utah. And it is neat that to go to events now, just not in Utah, but in other places in the western United States, and they're saying, what is going on in Washington County? What's happening there? And they want to learn from us. So it's neat. And it's cool.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's neat. Years ago, I won an award for sports writing, and I was at the award dinner, and they were serving this red punch, and they announced my name. I didn't think I was going to win. They announced third place, second place, and then first place. And when they announced my name, first place, my buddy I was sitting by started clapping, but I thought he was reaching out to shake my hand, so I reached over to shake his hand and hit one of the pitchers full of red punch on these white tablecloths. And then I still had to, after that, walk up to the front and accept the award and give a little speech. So I hope you didn't do anything like that. You were okay.
No, cool. I didn't. But it was nice. My wife my wife never comes to any of this stuff. My wife came to the award meeting, and yeah, it was just a great event. It was really fun.
Yeah, well, that is very cool. And something we should, you were talking earlier, Zach, about people way back when they were first setting up how to live here. Thinking forward, thinking about the future. And then you talk about Ron Thompson and how he was thinking about the future. And that, as hard as it may seem, you have to think about what's life going to be here in 2040, 2050, 2070, 2100. Mm-hmm. That boggles my mind. That's like telling me about $1 trillion. I have no concept of what $1 trillion is. Uh-huh. I have no concept of what 21 or 2070 or 2090 would be like. But that's part of what you do, right?
Yeah, and that was one of the heavy things about my job, because a lot of people come to me and say, you have a really hard job, and I do. I'm not. It is a tough job. But I remember one of the last bits of advice that Ron Thompson gave me, he said, Zach, my generation built Quail and Sand Hollow for your reservation, for your generation. And he says, so you owe it to the next generation. And he's like, every single generation of Washington County has always thought about the next generation with water. Mm. And if you go and you look at all the water projects, I mean, really, they weren't just talking about, hey, they were talking about, well, what's going to happen in 20 years. And so he basically said, you don't want your generation to be the generation to end that pattern.
Drop the ball.
Yeah. And so, in fact, I was in a meeting on Monday where we were talking about projects we plan to build when I'm retired. And so you just constantly have to think at, because a lot of times these water projects take 20, 30 years to build, like Chief Toka Reservoir. That was in the environmental review process for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And so, so by the time it's built, it'll be a 25-year process, and it's the same thing. So I'm buying land. I'm sometimes buying water rights. and anticipating this will never be built in my career, but I'll hand it to the next generation to build.
Do you think that there was opposition to Ron say, hey, we're going to build Quail Creek Reservoir like there is today?
Oh, well, there wasn't the environmental regulatory federal government aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that part was easy in the 80s.
And it's not easy now.
Oh, no, it's a total thing. But locally, there was opposition to building Quail Reservoir in Sand Hollow. A lot of people at the time said, yeah, our population, we have too many people here. And it's funny to go back to the 80s and see how many people were actually living here.
Yeah, like 20,000.
Some people said they didn't want to spend the money for it. I mean, every time there's a water project. I mean, if you go back and look at when the citizens dug a canal all the way up to Pine Valley Mountain from St. George City. There was a lot of discussion then about, well, that's a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take all these things. But they dug a canal. And then they went back a couple of years later and says, well, we should line the canal with clay. And that took a lot of time. And so every time there's a water project, there's a discussion that goes on. What's interesting to me is see communities throughout the West where generations ago they took a certain path, and now their generations being the current generations being punished for something that the previous generation didn't do. And that's why when we talked about water rates, one of the reasons why our water rates are so cheap here, some of the cheapest in the Western United States, is because of what Ron Thompson did in the 80s. And I want to make sure when the next host, the next person's talking, they can say, yeah, we have safe, reliable water at a very cheap price.
You and I will be gone, but somebody, maybe Carrie will be the water
guy. Yes. Yeah.
Well, so if you think about some of the project, maybe the one right now that is on perhaps indefinite hold is Lake Powell Pipeline. Mm-hmm. Whose baby was that? And was that part of the trying to think forward and maybe got a little too much pushback, unfortunately?
So Lake Powell Pipeline, yeah, I mean, they started talking about that in the 90s.
Okay.
Because they realized after they built Quail and Sand Hollow, they realized there's going to start to be gaps. And so they said, yeah, let's start building that. And so the Lake Powell Pipeline would assure water insurance for our county, like, till 2070, 2080, like, if you look at some of the variables there. So the Lake Powell Pipeline would answer water growth, essentially, for all the ground that could be developed in Washington County. If it had not been for the massive drought that dropped Lake Mead and Lake Powell so much, like if Lake Powell would have been at 80%, it's my opinion that we would have the Lake Powell Pipeline right now. But when the both reservoirs dropped so much, all projects on the Colorado River just got put on hold, and the Lake Powell Pipeline timing could not have been worse for that.
It was a PR nightmare more than anything else, really, because people say, oh, you can't take water out of that lake. It's already empty, you know.
So I talked to people in the lower basin that regulates their states where they were telling me, oh, yeah, it's a good project. You should build it. It's straightforward. Yeah, it's Utah's water. You know, all the things you would want them to say, they, like, supported it. But then when the lakes essentially dropped to the levels they did, and you have Las Vegas that has their intakes, like, high and dry, that they came back and says, yeah, now we adamantly oppose it. So...
Yeah. So all of a sudden, Zach has to find some different plan, different ideas to help. And that would, I guess, expedite some of your other projects that you're working on, like Chief Toker, which is, so where are we at now in Chief Toker, by the way?
So right now we're having to pre-qualify. So we qualified certain contractors. And so of those qualified contractors, we're having pre-meetings with them. And so we're going to put out the second bid to start actually building the dam that kind of goes above the ground. So we did the foundation of the dam, and now we're going to start building the actual dam that sticks above the ground here. So those bids will probably go out in December, and so you'll probably actually see construction out there again the early part of the spring.
I wanted to ask you, are there really people, and I guess the answer is probably yes, that all they do is build dams around the country? That's their specialty?
So there's engineers that's all they do. They specialize in the construction and building of dams.
Hmm.
On the construction side, there are some individuals that kind of specialize a little bit more in dams. We're not really building that many dams in the United States anymore, so more of what they do is like repair and replace dams.
Hmm.
And so this is kind of a unique process of building a new dam on a piece of land that's never had it. And so the construction of the dam, we just have to make sure that we're getting the right people there. But like the truck driver that's, you know, hauling the clay material. That doesn't necessarily have to be specialized. Right. But, yeah, like one of our inspectors, we specifically are utilizing him. He's a consultant because he helped build Sand Hollow Reservoir. And so he has knowledge on how to build a reservoir. So
knows what he's doing, theoretically.
Yeah, and so Sand Hollow is a great reservoir. And so we reached out to him, and we hired him to help us build it to make sure the contractor's following all the specs.
Okay, what's the award again that you won?
Utah Water Pioneer Award.
Utah Water Pioneer Award.
Cool. Yeah.
Our newly crowned Utah Water Pioneer, Zach Renstrom, is with me on the show. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Back here in our beautiful studio here on North Bluff Street with a wonderful view of the Red Rocks in Sandtown Park. I'm Andy. Zach Renstrom is here. Don't I have the best view in the world?
Right? Yeah, you know, I love this view, and it's just so beautiful today.
I can kind of see your office from here, Zach.
You can see Sugarloaf with the Dixie Rock, that's for sure.
Oh, you're on the other side of it, aren't
you?
Yeah. Okay, I guess I can't see it, but I know where it is.
Yeah, you can see all the people up there. Yeah. I think it's busy up there. Like this last weekend. Like, we have the Halloween park going thing on
right now at the Desert
Garden. So we have a lot of people. But with fall break, there was a lot of people up there. And it's neat to see them all going around enjoying it and all the families out there. So, yeah, people.
Tell us a little bit about the Desert Garden.
Oh, sorry. I should bring that up. Yeah. So we kind of do these themes. We have a guy named Ryan White. He's a landscape guy. And he just has a lot of energy and great ideas. And so he's created, like, this Halloween theme. And so we invite businesses to come and set up like little, like scarecrows, or they have really cool themes. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of go through and just walk through the desert and see these little things set up. And some of them are very elaborate and really clever. And so right now that's very popular. So yeah, I'd encourage people to come up and look at it and enjoy it. And it's really cool. And then you can like see how beautiful desert landscaping can be. And
yeah.
Once Halloween is over, well, they take it all down, and then we start putting up the Christmas lights right after that. So there's a lot going on up there.
I have not been up there during Halloween season, but I have been there a couple of different times during Christmas season. Yeah. In fact, if someone comes to town, I'm like, hey, you guys got to come see this. It's really cool.
Well, you should come up for Halloween. It's some of the stuff that these businesses come up with are really clever.
No, it's not scary, right? Like,
I've never
been a big fan of horror or torture or scary stuff.
It's not like gory, but it does have like clowns dressed up like crazy.
Pennywise.
So there's some clowns that kind of are creepy. Like there could be some things that might scare littler kids, but it's not like gory.
That's good.
So
that's good. Okay, Halloween at the Desert Garden, and that's just on Red Hills Parkway. Uh-huh. Somebody told me, I don't know if you know anything about this, it's not your department, but they are going to work on widening that road. Maybe it's over toward Washington City. Maybe I'm off base here, but they're gonna widen that road. I think where it kind of becomes Red Hills Parkway turns into Buena Vista, I think, is where they're talking about widening it and stuff. So
yeah, that's what I've heard in front of the Sugarloaf. I haven't heard of anything happening there for a while.
I hope not. That's a busy road. I got to tell you, they have what is now Skyline Drive leads up onto that, right? Uh-huh. And you turn onto there. So I go home from work every day in the afternoon, and that's when I'm going to be turning onto Red Hills Parkway. And I watch these cars that are about to turn left onto Skyline. Mm-hmm. And every single day, someone pulls in front of a car coming down that hill. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Are you stupid? Do you know how? And I know they reduce the speed limit coming down that hill, but you're in you're going 60 miles an hour. I think it's 50 or something, but mm-hmm. most people are going 60 coming down a hill. Mm-hmm. And then you're sitting, you're sitting there. Oh, he's way back down. I'm just going to turn. And I every day I see a near accident at mm-hmm. that same spot. It just amazes me. So,
and as you're coming down that hill, they have one of those signs that say your speed is this, and it flashes at you if you're going fast. But yeah, it makes me nervous. I kind of take that same path. Yeah. I haven't seen a wreck there yet, but I've seen a lot of police officers and close calls.
Yeah. I did a story on those speed trailers. They apparently lose effectiveness after about 2 weeks.
Oh.
For the first 2 weeks, they make a huge difference.
Yeah.
And then after about 2 weeks, people are like, whatever. Oh. And they ignore them.
So when the motorcycle cop is sitting down there at the bottom of that hill, that makes a lot of difference.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
And those guys give tickets. They don't give warnings, I found out.
Well, you didn't find out personally.
No, no, oh, no. Okay. I've never had a speeding ticket.
Never?
Never.
Wow.
So.
Well, that's why you are the Utah water pioneer. No, no, I guess it has nothing to do with that. But we're talking with Zach today. By the way, got 5 minutes left, 673-5890. If you want to ask Zach a question, you can text me as well at 467-5842. Now, you talked about not having the power to punish or power to you know, water abusers to get after them. So, I mean, if I'm a guy and I have a, you know, a 50,000 square foot lawn and I'm using a lot of water, and I mean, what happens to me? Nothing?
Well, you pay a big water bill.
Pay more. Yeah. But.
And I will say, this is Zach Renstrom's personal opinion. The authority and stuff like that should be given to elected leaders. And so, if they want to pass regulations and stuff like that, that is where it belongs. It shouldn't belong to a water district. And so that's why those elected leaders are there to make those decisions. We elect them and they make those tougher decisions. And so a lot of times cities come to me and say, hey, you know, blah, 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 or like, you should do this or do that. And I'm like, no, that's your job. When you said when you went out and asked people to vote for you, you said that you're going to make hard decisions, and all my job is to make sure that I just give you the options and the consequence to each option, and then you can choose. And so we have somebody right now with a very big lawn. What our elected leaders chose, and this actually goes all the way to the state, you know, our Utah state legislature, they're like, you need to go out there and you can charge them more for water, but that's it. Now, in other places, they do have a cap where you get so much water. And then they literally like start dialing back your water that you can get to your house. But here in Utah, our leader said, no, we're not doing that. So if somebody calls me up and says, you should do like dial it back or, you know, pull the water back or something like that, I'm like, well, hey, that's an interesting idea, but you really should talk to your legislator. And that's where it belongs.
It's fascinating because, I mean, you talk about, well, that's very un-American to limit the amount of water they can have, but. I got a phone right here. Guess what? At a certain point in the month, if I use too much data, they limit the amount of data I can use for the rest of the month. It may sound un-American, but it's reality, you know? And so, yeah, I see what you're saying, that it should be up to the cities to do it. But I think something should be done for water abusers, in my opinion.
So right now, on a typical year, they paid. Now, I will say, if there's a declared emergency or a declared national something, then there are certain things that like the mayor or the governor could come in and mandate saying you can't water outside. And so that has happened before in the state of Utah where there's like been a big pipe that burst and so at that point they're just trying to keep enough water for drinking, flushing toilets and fire. So there has been short term things where they've come in and declared emergency saying you can't water outside, but unless there's a declared emergency right now, we just do pricing.
Will there ever be a case, and only 2 minutes left, this is a big question, will there ever be a case, though, where we have to worry about contaminated water? You think of Flint, Michigan, and some of the places that have had those problems. And I know it's your job to make sure this doesn't happen, but could there be some kind of disaster or some kind of reason where that actually might happen?
Yes.
Yes.
And I'm not going to elaborate.
Okay.
Because we spend a lot of time on emergency operations.
Earthquake comes to my mind, but...
So, and it wouldn't be an earthquakes. Don't
no.
I mean, earthquakes would be bad, but that's not necessarily what scares me.
Really?
But we do have emergency operation plans in place that if our water becomes contaminated, on how we would respond to such event.
Terrorist attack.
I'm not going to elaborate.
Oh, come on, Zach.
In our emergency operation plan, we try to think of all the different scenarios that could happen that could affect the water and how we would properly respond.
Well, hopefully, like insurance, you hope you never have to use it. Yep. Like emergency plans, hopefully you never have to implement those.
And we spend a lot. We spend a lot of money on tools that I hope I never use.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the reality of life, right?
Yeah,
that's the reality of life. So, I hope to never have to use my car insurance.
Exactly. But it still costs. I just pay my car insurance, and it
costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
But you know what? If I ever get in a wreck, it'll be sure nice to be nice to have it if I need it.
And it's always that balance of how much insurance too. And so that's what we have to deal with is how many things do we buy to be prepared?
Yeah, that's a good point. Zach Renstrom, congratulations on the award, Zach.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Kerry, thanks for cluing me in because he never would have said a word probably. the Utah water pioneer. Way to go. That's Zach Renstrom. Hey, everybody, thanks for listening. Tomorrow we've got, tomorrow's Thursday. Oh, well, Celeste Malloy is going to join me live on the air here. We'll talk to you then.